It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. After conservative activist Charlie Kirk was shot and killed last week, social media lit up with strong reactions.
And not all of them were sympathetic to his death. Some people posted criticism of Kirk's controversial views on race, gender, sexuality, and religion, many of which he shared during a campus visit to UW-Madison last year.
At least two people in Wisconsin have lost their jobs as a direct result of social media posts about Kirk after the shooting.
Vice President J.D. Vance hosted an episode of Kirk's podcast yesterday and delivered this message.
So when you see someone celebrating Charlie's murder, call them out. In hell, call their employer.
The social media discourse following Kirk's assassination has sparked a national debate about the First Amendment and freedom of speech, something Kirk himself said he was a strong advocate for.
Francisca Coleman is an assistant professor of constitutional law at the UW Law School, where she researches First Amendment law and social regulation of speech, often referred to as cancel culture. Francisca, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
You describe cancel culture as social regulation of speech, where the consequences for expression are not from the government, but from all the people around us, from society. Is that what's happening in cases like this where workers are fired for social media posts about Charlie Kirk?
Yes, you definitely, in most cases, have people who see the post on social media who bring it to the attention of their employers. Normally it's more than one person, but sometimes it could, you know, depending on the person, if they are very influential or, you know, given, you know, that the vice president has kind of said, call these people out, then that kind of adds a little bit of gravitas to any other kind of accusations that come. So it doesn't actually have to be a group of people once you have kind of the highest authority in the state kind of saying, we want to find out who these people are. We want you to let their employers know. Because, I mean, the subtext of that, right, is that employers, when they're made aware, should take steps. So sometimes it requires multiple people multiple times. But I think in this context, it could just be a single person who, you know, takes the VP up on his recommendation and reaches out to an employer.
Because crowdsourced, you know, online naming and shaming of people, that's not new. But I think what I'm hearing, what's different now about the people making the calls to fire people due to their posts, it's coming from the highest levels of government. Is that different?
So I don't know that it's kind of different. I think that, well, maybe it is in a way. I think one of the things that I kind of say in my writing is that what happens to a person who's called out on social media always depends on their proximity to power. Mm. And so you can kind of get that proximity to power in multiple ways. And so one way to get that proximity to power, right, is to actually have, you know, the kind of administration saying, you know, please, you know, let employers know if you see this kind of language. But there are other ways to kind of have proximity to power, like celebrities, you know, who are kind of saying, oh my gosh, we need to watch out for these people. We need to, you know, so it's not, so I think the way in which the accusers of the employees who are posting negative things about Charlie Kirk, the way in which, you know, proximity is defined in their case is unique, but the fact that it's always a matter of proximity to power has not changed.
When we've talked to you in the past, you have said that cancel culture is mediated by institutions. And in this case, that's employers deciding to fire employees based on their speech. What is an organization's responsibility in regulating the speech of its employees?
I think their primary responsibility is to make sure, if they're a private employer, to make sure that their employees have notice. Some companies have social media policies that are very vague, so employees aren't really on notice. Others have no social media policy at all. And then I think the other responsibility, aside from notice, is proportionality. I think not all of the comments about Charlie Kirk are kind of equally worthy of condemnation, are equally insensitive, are rude. Some of them kind of have, you know, more implicit lack of sympathy, and others are quite overt. Like, I have zero sympathy, clap, 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 right? And so I think kind of trying to not have a one size fits all, and also thinking about the employee's kind of course of conduct. I mean, if this is the first time they've ever had any kind of issues, I think that employee should be treated differently than an employee who, you know, every other day is embroiling the company in some kind of social media fiasco. And so I think considering the work history of the employee in terms of their, how they've been a responsible and good employee, proportionality, and also making sure that there was adequate notice.
Posting on social media, it leaves a record. It is proof in a way. How consequential is that permanence?
I think it's becoming increasingly consequential because I've heard, I know one of, some advice that we give to our students that are on the market, right, is to check their social media because sometimes when people are making hiring decisions, right, they are kind of looking up, the potential employees on social media. But I also think, amazingly, you find posts from like years ago that come up. I mean, now it's posts, but before, it was kind of like newspaper clippings, pictures in yearbooks. But so permanence, is not a definitely a new thing. But I think just this is kind of an issue because people change, right, over time, and standards change, right? And so things that were relatively uncontroversial, maybe 10 years ago, then you unearth them, 10 years later, and they seem extremely problematic and troubling. And so I think the permanence by itself is not a problem, but like how we take into account the changing of times between when something may have been posted and how it's received now. And so I don't know that we can do anything about the permanence. I mean, we don't quite have a robust right to be forgotten here in the US, but I think people who are consumers of this media, just taking into consideration, yes, this stuff is permanent, but the person may have changed in the interim.
We're talking with UW Madison Law Professor Francisca Coleman as we look at free speech and the consequences in social media reaction following Charlie Kirk's killing. Are there protections for workers in this moment? Are there any legal protections for expression in these posts?
So for private parties, they are not quite bound by the First Amendment, and many employees are at-will employees. So any kind of protections would be contractual. And so if they have, some kind of contractual right to due process, if some employers actually have committed in their kind of employment manuals or employee manuals to protecting free speech. And so I think it's going to be a matter of contract, but in the absence of any kind of contractual commitment by the employer or kind of any kind of bargain for due process protections by the worker, then I think the worker doesn't really have a lot of recourse. For a private employer, just because if they're an at-will employee, if they're not an at-will employee, of course, it's a completely different story.
And in that's private sector, Pentagon leaders announced a zero tolerance policy for military personnel making light of Kirk's death. Is there a gray area when the government is your employer?
So there is kind of a gray area. I mean, there's a standard, but the standard is a standard, not a rule. And so the standard has a couple of elements. So first, if it's on a matter of public concern, which the kind of shooting of Charlie Kirk would be, and then the second is, are you speaking within, is speaking out, is this, are you kind of giving this speech, this expression within the course of your duties as an employee? So as a professor, normally everything I say is kind of part of my duties. And so some people who have administrative positions like chancellors, maybe even a dean of students, there may be an argument that some of your kind of public-facing words are the words of your employer. But if that's not the case, then you have this kind of Pickering balance, which basically kind of evaluates, like, is your speech kind of disruptive to your employer? Like, so disruptive, like the value to society and the value to you of kind of being able to make that speech, is it outweighed, right, by the cost to your employer in terms of efficiency, workplace harmony, that kind of thing. And so that balancing test, is very, it can go either way. It's really going to depend on a judge. And so that's one aspect. And then I think in the military context, you have another issue, which is maybe if you kind of kind of satisfy all of these elements. Maybe they could also say, national security concerns. And so that may be kind of a part of the balance that would not be present for a regular employee. And so I think the kind of national security concern and the interests of the military and kind of having a unified force and we're not having too many schisms in the ranks, then that might be an added concern that the military has that maybe other government employees wouldn't have.
So, as we walk this line, where is the line between a healthy disagreement about someone's actions or someone's beliefs versus the extremes of celebrating or glorifying someone's death?
So I think we're kind of in a state where a lot of the speech is contested. I mean, I think that there was a time when we could agree, like, oh, glorifying this is bad, or this is kind of a glorification. But now I think we are in a time where people feel that strong words are needed in order to bring attention to certain circumstances. And so you just think about the strong words that you hear in relation to the Israel-Palestine issue. And I think people feel, particularly people who are concerned about gun violence in America, they feel that strong words are needed, right? This is a moment in which we can use these strong words to bring attention to this problem. There is a sense in which, the kind of civility and what we the norm of civility has eroded. And I just think people now have different metrics by which they feel like there are certain circumstances in which the norm of civility can be set aside, but we don't agree on when those circumstances are. And I think it's a problem of, when I feel like there is a kind of pressing issue that requires dramatic speech, then that's when civility can be set aside. People outside of my discourse community disagree. So that's not an answer, but I think people are going to come to that question in different ways depending on where they're standing. But I do think we have had an erosion, of the norm of civility.
Francisca Coleman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Francisca Coleman is an assistant professor of constitutional law at the UW Law School. She was with us to share her expertise on the First Amendment and cancel culture in the wake of conservative activist Charlie Kirk being shot and killed last week on a Utah college campus.
Coming up, data centers are going up around Wisconsin. Hear how one community is meeting this moment with prospective developers.
No matter how big this company is behind the data center project, they still have to follow our processes. They still have to, come and have a public hearing on their proposals.
And a look at the environmental footprint of data centers. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Data centers across the U.S. are growing fast as tech companies respond to the AI boom.
These centers bring in new jobs, but they are resource intensive, needing constant electricity and a reliable source of water to cool computer processors and equipment.
Wisconsin has 47 data centers, according to the data center map. But a new report from the Alliance for the Great Lakes suggests that Wisconsin and all Great Lakes states need to make urgent water policy changes.
Later, we'll hear from the report author about large water users and environmental protections.
But first, we zoom in on Menominee in northwestern Wisconsin. Its city council voted to annex and rezone about 320 acres of farmland.
There's no guarantee what this land will be used for yet, but a proposal for a $1.6 billion data center sparked controversy among residents. Menominee elderperson Cody Gentz joins us now. Cody, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hello, it's great to be here.
At the time of this recording, there are over 7,000 people in a Facebook group opposing a data center that is a possibility for your community. What are the major concerns that have come up from Menominee residents about a proposal?
Yeah, so there are a number of things that have come up, but I think there are a few big ones that really stand out. Folks are worried about water usage, power usage, light and noise pollution, and then obviously the loss of farmland in that area.
And we also heard from Alderperson Sydney Brennan, who said in an email to us about residents, they want economic development, but they also want to weigh that against environmental impacts and other challenges. You know, Brennan feels that many residents kind of fall somewhere in the middle on a project like this. What is your response to that?
I'd say that's fairly accurate. I do know that there are a number of folks who are very opposed to the idea of a data center. And I've received a lot of negative feedback, but I think in general, you know, a lot of people are cognizant that, you know, we need economic development and this would be one way to do it. I think everybody is just a little bit, you know, nervous and cautious and, you know, the kind of how this project has proceeded being so big, and how the company is behind like a shell LLC that has not inspired confidence. But I think, you know, generally it's mixed. I would agree with that.
Cody, so big, so secret. You mentioned the LLC here. The proposal is from an undisclosed tech company. What can you tell us about what's in the proposal?
Yeah, so we know that the total investment for this project would be around $1.6 billion, which for our area is huge. And the estimated tax revenue for the city would be, I think, if I recall right, you know, $1 million per year, which is massive. I think the city brings in $7 million a year in property taxes as it is now. So an extra million is like an extra 12.5%. There's also the possibility of, I believe the estimate was 50 to 75 like high-paying technical roles, technical jobs. So yeah, that's kind of what we've been told about the project thus far. It's all sort of an estimate and very preliminary, but that's the numbers we're working with.
Take us back to the city council vote about the annexation and the rezoning of the 324 acres of farmland. Is the annexation and the rezoning tied to the data center proposal, or is it separate?
Technically they are separate. Mm. The, you know, prospect of a data center coming in is what spurred the annexation and the rezone, but the annexation and the rezone happening does not guarantee that a data center is coming. As far as I know, we are not sure if the developer has even bought the land or committed to building anything. You know, all we know right now is that, you know, that parcel is now in the city limits and is zoned industrial. So say this balloonist LLC decides they don't want to build a data center here. Something else could eventually be on that land in the future.
You voted against the annexation ultimately. What went into your vote? What did you think about?
So I often balance the economic side of things with the feedback from the community. You know, I'm a numbers guy. I have a degree in computer science and a minor in economics. So I like looking at the numbers. And, you know, I'll admit at the, you know, outset of this project, the numbers seemed pretty good. And so I was, you know, I was skeptical, of course, but, you know, I was interested to sort of see how things played out. But as feedback rolled in from the community, I had people from my ward contacting me saying that, you know, they just didn't think this project was good for the city, as well as the, you know, secretive nature of the development, which, you know, is not unique to this project and is not unique to Menominee. But, you know, I wanted to, you know, honor the feedback that I had gotten from the community and people in my ward. And I wanted to also sort of take a stand against some of this secretive, you know, ways that large developers act these days.
Are you concerned at all about the natural resources if it ultimately does turn into a data center? The
electricity and water requirements for such a facility?
Yeah, that's definitely on the top of my mind, especially the power usage, because, you know, that's governed by the Public Service Commission. So we don't have as much influence over, you know, what happens with our electrical rates. So that's something I'm keeping a very close eye on. And the water usage as well. While they have said that the preliminary plans for this data center would use a closed loop water system, so it would use a lot less water than some of the other data centers we've seen around the country, water around here is still a very precious resource. And, you know, we have a lot of people around here that care deeply about, you know, our water and our watershed. And so I want to make sure that we're treating that with the utmost respect.
Cody, what is the next step for this 324 acres?
So right now we are, you know, kind of waiting for the developer to make a move and come back to the city with more detailed plans. I think a possible next step could be a development agreement where the developer and the city would work out an agreement about, you know, what gets built and if there's any sort of tax structures, TIDs, things like that. And so I'm kind of looking out for that. And I think if that does come, it'll be very important to get a lot of public input. You know, I know some folks feel that this process is going extremely fast. And I understand it can really feel that way sometimes. But, you know, no matter how big this company is behind the data center project, they still have to follow our processes. They still have to, you know, come and have a public hearing on their proposals. And so there's still going to be a lot of opportunity for the council and the public to sort of examine this, do due diligence, and weigh in. And it's interesting because it is bringing together people from vastly different political and economic, you know, backgrounds to, you know, investigate this project, in some cases oppose it. But it is very, you know, inspiring to see folks getting more engaged with local politics. You know, seeing a packed audience room is quite amazing when I'm used to seeing in just a handful of folks.
Cody, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Cody Gentz, an elder person for Menominee. He shared residents' concerns about the environmental effects of a proposed data center in their city. According to a new report from the Alliance for the Great Lakes, data centers are increasing in number and putting pressure on freshwater resources. Because Great Lakes states are experiencing this stepped-up demand for land and water, the report authors urge an expansion of freshwater protections. To learn more, we turn to Helena Volzer, Senior Source Water Policy Manager at the Alliance for the Great Lakes and author of this report that focuses on large water users. Helena, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Your report explains how data centers use resources like electricity and water. Can you explain the scope of usage of these precious resources, you know, for data centers?
Yeah, sure. I'll start with some basics. So data centers use water for cooling. And what's really happening now and what we're seeing is a growth in the term hyperscale data centers. These are really, really large facilities. And when data centers use water, there's a variety of cooling methods they could use inside that system. The most common really appears to be evaporative cooling, where water is sort of pushed through a membrane in the server room to bring down the temperature inside. Those server racks get hot from all of the computing that they're doing. When that method is used, more than half of the water evaporates. Whatever isn't evaporated is then either discharged or it can be recirculated once it's cooled down. A data center that's using evaporative cooling can use between 1 and 5 million gallons a day. To put that in perspective a little bit, you know, that 365 million gallons a year at the 1 million gallon per day level, right? That's equivalent to what 12,000 Americans use in a year. So it's a lot of water, and it's a lot of consumptive use of water. And that is water that's not being returned necessarily to the watershed. And so unlike those Americans, right, the water's not being returned back to where it originated from.
We heard the term used closed loop system in the potential one for Menominee. Is that more sustainable?
Yeah, we really don't have very good insight right now into what's the best practices to use in a data center. What I do know with a closed loop system is it has a tendency to use less water, but if more electricity is used in exchange, just because it uses less water, if it uses more electricity and that electricity is being generated by fossil fuels, coal, gas, oil, or nuclear, there's still water being used consumptively for generation to turn the turbines that generate that energy. And energy generation is one of the largest using consumptive use water sectors. So there's this connection between water and energy, and there are trade-offs. And right now, due to the lack of transparency around this sector, we really don't have good insight into what are the best practices.
What about gray water or non-potable water? Could that be used to cool these data centers? Does it need to be fresh water?
Yeah, it could. It very well could. Data centers don't need finished potable drinking water that you and I are drinking every day. And so some states have started to take a look at this. Ohio and Illinois, which are 4 and 5 in the country right now for the number of data centers they have enacted established chapters of something called a water reuse association. And they're beginning to take a look at this, at what kind of laws and regulations might be needed to accommodate the reuse of non-potable water, because there's a lot to consider with that kind of reuse. So, other states are starting to take a look at that. And that's something that we recommend in the report, is that states start exploring, what are the best practices and ways to allow for that non-potable reuse. And at the same time, setting some conservation and efficiency standards for this industry.
Go further into some of those ideas, suggestions, and standards for different Great Lakes states. I mean, what are some of the more urgent suggestions that you would have for Wisconsin in particular?
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that the policy recommendations we make in the report, there are several that are broadly applicable regardless of which state in the region you're talking about. And the first one, the most pressing need right now is a need for regional demand studies that look into a state in a more localized way and figure out where water is available and where it's not. Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana have started to do these kinds of demand studies. Ohio recently completed one for the Central Ohio area, and it's really telling because it identifies gaps in capacity, where water is available and where it's not. And so these studies both need to be funded and they need to be used by economic development corps in deciding where to locate and site and incentivize in those making those decisions, both by the economic development corps and local governments could turn to these kinds of studies.
So you're saying like Wisconsin could do more groundwater and aquifer mapping to manage the groundwater before there's a crisis situation with wells or aquifers?
Absolutely, yeah. Groundwater funding for groundwater mapping. The more information we have, the better ability to predict this demand. We'll be able to make better decisions in terms of sustainability for water resources. In addition, what we found in the report is that Great Lakes states, by and large, do not have the tools necessary to curb or limit groundwater usage before there's been some kind of adverse resource impact. And so in a state like Wisconsin, that's really reliant on groundwater for drinking water supplies. I think Wisconsin's at 75% of Wisconsin residents rely on groundwater for their drinking water. We feel it's important for this state and for all states in the region to be thinking about water more holistically.
How does Wisconsin versus other states resolve groundwater legal disputes?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that Wisconsin falls into the category of a lot of states, which is ultimately relying on litigation when it comes to groundwater disputes. The state can establish groundwater management areas once a certain threshold's been hit to sort of limit groundwater usage from permitted users. But one of the issues we haven't really touched on yet is that data centers, by and large, are connecting to municipal supplies, and that completely eliminates them from the requirement to obtain consumptive use permits or register with the state. And so there's a lack of transparency there in terms of how much water they're using, because the public water system is the one that actually has to report on water usage, not the data center. So any large industrial user that's connecting to municipal supplies isn't required to track and report its water usage. And when it comes to data centers, less than a third of them are even tracking their water use. Hmm. And then 97% of data center operators are connecting in this way to municipal supplies.
These data centers, they're going up fast. It seems like here in the Midwest, there is a lot of development underway. Is that swiftness of the rollout of these centers, can that ultimately have an impact on your natural resources if you don't have the protections in place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're pointing to these regional demand studies to quickly get a better handle on available demand and supply, right? Mm-hmm. But you can potentially, use up groundwater resources and cause the kinds of conflicts that our report kind of advises that states take action now to implement some of these policy recommendations to avoid that kind of result.
You heard how residents of Menominee are reacting to this proposal for a data center in their community. Hundreds of acres of farmland was annexed. What do you think of the response to this project that is under consideration in the community? And does it remind you of other communities?
Yeah, this story has played out in a number of communities throughout the Great Lakes region. And this issue of water use and energy use and all of the associated impacts with data centers has really had an overwhelming response. We've had a really great response to the report, which is available at greatlakes.org for those that are interested in it. It's a common story, right? You have non-disclosure agreement, something obscuring the transparency of how much water and energy is even proposed to be used. In this case, obscuring the name of the company that's actually going to be locating there. That's a common story that we see. One of the other recommendations in the report is we need some public disclosure requirements at the outset, how much water and energy is proposed to be used so the community can make better decisions. I think that's why you've sort of seen some of this reaction in terms of the response, that lack of transparency. In our case, we're making the point that, there's also a need for ongoing water use reporting requirements. Once it's been built, how much water is it using and is it sticking to that?
Helena, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is Helena Volzer, Senior Source Water Policy Manager at Alliance for the Great Lakes. Their new report is called A Finite Resource, and it focuses on heavy water use industries. Earlier, we heard from Menominee Elderperson Cody Gentz, who talked about the concerns that residents have over a proposal for a data center in that community.
Coming up, if you've ever had trouble pronouncing a place name in Wisconsin, you're not alone. We'll meet the creator of the website, Miss Pronouncer, and find out the one mistake she wants everyone to avoid.
Randomly, I'd hear people say Wisconsin, and it would just kind of get my goat.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You may have seen the joke before. You're not a true Wisconsinite unless you know how to pronounce Oconomowoc.
And that's not the only tongue twister here in the state. You've got Wauwatosa, New Berlin, not New Berlin, and don't forget Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. The list goes on.
As radio broadcasters, it's kind of our job to know this stuff, and we do need help from time to time. For many years, Harold Ingalls' book, Wisconsin Place Names, A Pronouncing Gazetteer, was a vital resource around here.
But there's nothing quite like hearing the correct pronunciation to really get it in your head. That's where former broadcaster Jackie Johnson came in. Back in 2005, she started a new website to help people say Wisconsin place names like a local. It's called mispronouncer.com. This year, the website is celebrating 20 years online, plus the state cartographer's office just released a new interactive map called Pronounce Wisconsin that uses Jackie's audio clips. Jackie Johnson is a former reporter anchor for Wisconsin Radio Network. She's the creator behind the website mispronouncer.com. And Joe Sammons is a professor of linguistics at UW-Madison and co-founder of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He co-edited the book Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And Jackie, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
All right, Jackie, I was an early adopter of your website, Mispronouncer. I started here in 99. We had a book that we used for a lot of place name pronouncers. You came along in, I think, 2005 with Mispronouncer, and we loved it here. What led you to make these recordings of yourself saying Wisconsin place names and share them online with the world?
Oh, gee, I was really dedicated at that time. I don't know what came over me. It was a lot of work. but I was in broadcast radio doing the morning shift, and I was reading some AP, some wire copy, and sometimes a name of a city came across that I didn't recognize, and there was nobody around. You know, sometimes when you do the morning shift, there's no one else in the building. You know, you're the first one there sometimes. And so after a while, I thought, man, this can't keep happening regularly. I need to figure this out. I need to get some sort of guide. And I wasn't aware of that book that has some pronunciations in there. So I just compiled a list. I went through all the work and effort of calling people if I didn't know and put it all together.
And Jackie, we both work in radio or have worked in radio. This is an occupational hazard. And I know one time we had a new announcer give Waukesha instead of Waukesha. You hear about that, right? When you say somebody's town name wrong, they take umbrage.
Well, yes. And you know what? Sometimes when I watch local TV news or radio, and this is not a criticism of anybody per se, but if I hear a new broadcaster and they do say something like that, I kind of cringe and I think, well, it's not as though there's not a reference out there for them.
Now, Joe, you've done a lot of linguistic research looking at Wisconsin. What do you see as the value of a database like Mispronouncer and now Pronounce Wisconsin, which takes Jackie's work and puts it on a map?
Oh, it's huge. One of the things that we really want to understand these days is how, not just how language varies over space, how it varies from one place to another, but also how it changes over time. And these resources are great for seeing that and for being able to track it. I use it regularly in teaching. I'm teaching a course called Language in Wisconsin this semester, and I've got a bunch of students who are actually interested in place names, and they're already looking at it and looking at what how local pronunciations are different from what's recorded there and how things have changed over time.
Yeah, my grandpa is from Port Huron, Michigan, which he called till the end of his days Port Yorn, Michigan.
Yeah.
Jackie, did you run into a lot of contested pronunciations? I've heard arguments over Racine versus Racine, for example.
Yeah, I think that one is the biggest one. So Racine could be Racine, Racine, or Racine. In fact, I talked to some people who lived there for a long time, and they kind of assured me. They said, well, as long as you're somewhere in the middle, don't say Racine or Racine. Just kind of say it fast enough, and maybe no one will notice. But another big one that comes to mind is like Two Rivers. I mean, it's spelled like you can imagine, T-W-O-2 and then Rivers. But locals might say Trivers.
Sure. And Joe, how common is that? We may have an accepted pronunciation, but language happens in the real world.
It happens in the real world. In fact, the first time I ever used the word, the place name Two Rivers, was around somebody from Sturgeon Bay. And she stopped me in absolute horror and said, never say that, say Trivers. it changes and it varies a whole lot. So the small town in northern Wisconsin, Oulu, most people say now, was traditionally, it's a Finnish town named after a town in Finland, city in Finland, and it was traditionally pronounced Oulu. And there's still people in town who say it that way, but now it's mostly Oulu. And you have, I mean, examples like New Berlin for what was once upon a time Berlin or Berlin. And Prairie du Chien has the same kind of story as Two Rivers. There's an old traditional pronunciation. So I think that that really adds a lot of richness that we're seeing these variations and this change over time.
Jackie, do you have you had people argue with the pronunciations you put online?
Yes and no. It was always a polite argument or maybe a suggestion or something like that. Once or twice. I mean, nothing major, but it definitely is the subject for conversation. And I see it even now on, you know, Facebook or other social media. You've got people talking about it and pointing to the website or making little videos when a sports team comes out of town. It comes from out of town. You know, you've seen those before.
Now, with something like Racine, I don't care how they say it, as long as they keep making the Kringle for me. But Jackie,
yes.
you have one that does bug you right at the top of your website. We are from the state of Wisconsin, not the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think that was always a big thing for me, long before I even thought of the idea for the website. People would say I would pick up on things. I'm a great observer, and I would listen to people talk. I would always watch the three major TV network news broadcasters. You remember Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings. So I would hear people talk, but then randomly I'd hear people say Wisconsin, and it would just kind of get my goat.
We are talking about Wisconsin's unique place names and how to say them. Jackie Johnson is with us, the creator behind mispronouncer.com, and Joe Salmons, a linguist at UW-Madison and co-editor of a book called Wisconsin Talk. Well, Joe, I think one of the challenges of trying to say all these Wisconsin place names right is there's a lot of diversity in the languages that they came from and then the languages they were translated or interpreted to. Can you share some of that history behind our wide variety of place names?
It's just remarkably local. It changes almost every place you go. Almost every place name has its own different history. You see a lot of names that were a lot of the native names, indigenous place names in the state were first, of course, in French and then came into English. So you've got these really complicated patterns of transmission. You've got places that were named, given names in immigrant languages or indigenous languages, and those have changed over time. And because we have so many different languages and cultures that have made up the state historically, we do have that just more richness than almost any place in the country, I think, in terms of how many different sources we have.
So, Joe, hypothetically, we could have a pronunciation that's how, what, Polish immigrants pronounce the French translation of an Ojibwe word, right? I mean, it can be that complicated.
It can be that complicated, and it even gets more complicated. The famous case of the name of the state is the subject of a bunch of scholarly literature. There are articles about how Wisconsin came to be called Wisconsin and what it means. It looks like it was probably originally written with an M at the beginning, and somebody just misinterpreted it, wrote it as a W, and so it changed in that way. And there's a lot of literature about it came from one of the Algonquian languages. A lot of people say Ojibwe, some people say Miami, Illinois. And it's just hard to tell because of that complicated transmission. It was first attested in French, then it came into English, and of course, through lots of different other communities with different kinds of speech.
Interesting. Now, I promised I'd share some of mine. I mentioned this on the air the other day. Oregon, not the state of Oregon, but the Wisconsin town of Oregon, is one that puts me into this feedback loop of second-guessing myself. Jackie, that one, I mean, it's pretty easy to denote how to pronounce that. Is that one you've encountered people stumbling over?
Yes, and I kind of smirked when you said that, because not just people, quote-unquote, but me, myself. I have to think about it. I have to pause before I say that one, too.
All right. And this is a pretty common thing, Joe, where you mentioned we've got Berlin, not Berlin. You heard me pause there. This seems like pretty often that you'd have that expected accent and it swaps for some reason in that local name.
Yeah. What happens is over time, as the languages being used in a community change, people's pronunciation habits change. And there was, of course, a long time in that part of the state, German was very widely spoken, not just by people who came or whose families came from Germany, but a lot of Anglo-Americans and others learned German. And so they knew German pronunciations and they used German pronunciations. But as that faded away, people have shifted slowly to using more and more English pronunciations. And where the history is deeper, where the language is further away, like in the case of French in Wisconsin, you get pronunciations that are really very far from French. I mean, Lake Butamore is just, if you say that to a French person, they're typically amused.
Well, there's one that derives from French. That's another Rob stumbling block. Lac de Flambeau, I think I just nailed it. But in the moment, live on the air, I start thinking Lac de Flambeau. No, it's Lac de Flambeau. Jackie, that's one of those French ones. I'm, again, notoriously bad at anything French. Is this a common stumbling block, those French origin names?
Yes, and Fond du Lac.
Yeah, people want to do Fond du Lac.
Yes, yes.
All right, I got one, Joe, a mystery for me. The case of the missing A, I'm talking about Shawano, Wisconsin. Mm. You look at it, it looks like a three-syllable word, Shawano. This stymied me for a long time. Joe, what happened? Where'd that syllable go?
It's just perfectly normal pattern of English. It's an unstressed syllable, and so you just lose it. It's a Menominee name. It's a Menominee word. It's the word that means in modern Menominee, Suwano means south or southern. The town is actually named after a Menominee leader. There are two people with the same name, so we don't know for sure which one. But it got adapted into English that way, with that unstressed syllable being lost. And it's definitely one of the confusing ones for newcomers.
It's perfectly normal. Nothing to see here.
Now, Jackie, in your work on Mispronouncer, I'm guessing you've talked to a lot of people around the state, trying to confirm pronunciations, things like that. Do people take a lot of pride, and do people have a lot of strong opinions about how to say their local place names?
Yes, they do. And when I first created the site, that's what I did, is I talked to a lot of people, whether I called them on the phone or visited locals. And, you know, obviously a lot of them I knew because I grew up in the state in various cities. And I worked in radio for 30 plus years. So, you know, you just listen to people, you pay attention. And a lot of people were proud to tell me about their city, how it's pronounced, and how other people don't know enough to pronounce it accurately. I mean, you get all these stories, and it's nice. It's nice to hear. But as you stated earlier, even to this day, once in a while, someone will contact me and say, wait a minute, I have a disagreement with that one there.
And Joe, I know at various points in U.S. history there have been efforts to record people talking, right, in their languages of origin and their unique accents. Do we have a good, I guess, geology? Can we go back through time and see how the accent has changed?
Yes, indeed. We have the great Frederick Cassidy, who started the Dictionary of American Regional English, did recordings around Wisconsin in 1950 and 51. And a lot of those recordings were of older people. People did oral history recordings starting in the 1940s in various languages and in English. And so we've got lots of stuff. We've got old recordings of Cornish people from Mineral Point and on and on. So we've got lots of that, and we can go back. The recordings are good enough that we can actually do phonetic analysis of them and see how things have changed. And of course, like Jackie says, people talk a lot about place names, about where they're from, where they've moved to, and so forth. So that's a pretty prominent part of the record.
Jackie, Mispronouncer just had its 20th birthday. Now we've got that new map from the State Cartographer's Office featuring your voice. What's it like now, 20 years in, to have your voice be representing the place names of Wisconsin?
Well, it's really awesome, and it's an honor. And I think the folks at the Cartographer's Office, they've done a very good job, and they're always tweaking it and revising it. And I'm really proud to see that. But to be quite honest, every once in a while when I go back and I listen to one of the names, I thought, oh, that's nice. Nice job. And then I listen to another one. Oh, my gosh, that's terrible. I really need to re-record that. I always want to re-record everything I've ever done.
We'll leave it there. Jackie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
I really enjoyed it.
That was Jackie Johnson, former radio broadcaster and the creator of Mispronouncer.com, and Joe Sammons, a linguist at UW-Madison. We've been talking about Wisconsin's place names and how language and pronunciation evolves over time as Mispronouncer marks its 20th anniversary this year.
Speaking of place names in Wisconsin, we got an email from listener Petra in Wanakee, who wanted to know how to pronounce the name of a river, a lake, and a wildlife area in northern Wisconsin. It is spelled T-O-T-O-G-A-T-I-C. Rob, you dug into this one. What did you find out?
So to look at it, it could be Totogaddick, Totogaddick, but then I looked in our WPR Classic, Wisconsin Place Names book, and it was there.
And the official pronunciation is?
It is Totogaddick. Totogaddick.
Okay. Do you have a place name in Wisconsin that you always have trouble saying? Or do people always mess up your hometown? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Avery Lee Rogers, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.